Hello, and welcome to the very first episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel. My name is Jeremy Bement. I will be your host for this podcast, and I hope you really enjoy it. For those people who don't know me, I have been a podcaster for about 6 years now. I do another podcast called Doctor Who Panel to Panel, and basically it's all about Doctor Who comics. That podcast started out as basically me wanting to do a podcast looking at Doctor Who comics and talking to the writers and artists and creators of Doctor Who comics, not just the present comics, but going back in time, going back in history and taking a look at those and chatting with people and finding out how they got into comics, how they got into Doctor Who, why they wanted to do comic books, the process behind doing them, where they got their inspirations from, all that sort of thing, as well as keeping people up to date as to what new stuff is coming out in way of Doctor Who comics. Star Trek Panel to Panel is basically going to mirror that same formula, that same format, and we will be chatting with writers and artists and creators of Star Trek comics, not just from current comics, but also going back in time and taking a look at Star Trek comics. Star Trek comics have been coming out since the Gold Key days back in the late 60s. And hopefully we'll be able to chat with some of the people who have created Star Trek comics over the years to find out why they love Star Trek so much, why they love the comic medium so much, and how they do their craft. And I hope you come along with me on this journey, and I hope we have a blast, and I hope that you enjoy hearing the podcast that I put out episode by episode. This premiere episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, I think you'll enjoy. We are going to take a look at the 4-issue miniseries that IDW put out roughly about the same time that the very first Star Trek movie came out with Zachary Quinto and Chris Pine. They did a miniseries called Spock Reflections, which loosely tied in with that movie. It was written by Scott and David Tipton, with art by David Messina, and I was fortunate enough to chat with Scott and David Tipton about this miniseries. And I think you'll enjoy hearing about how they got into being interested in Star Trek, as well as being interested in comic books, what led them to become writers for IDW, why they enjoy doing what they do, and whatever else we talked about. So I hope you'll enjoy that. I hope you enjoy this episode. Not only that, but we'll also cover some news. We'll try to get you up to date as to what's going on in the world of Star Trek comics. I hope you enjoy it. If you're new to Star Trek comics, or maybe you've only been reading Star Trek comics since IDW has been putting them out, well, did you know that Star Trek comics have been coming out since the late 60s? Yeah, way back in the original Trek days, Gold Key Comics had the rights to Star Trek. Well, if you want to try to amass a collection of all the Star Trek comics that have come out over the decades, you could spend the rest of your natural life trying to track them all down as you go from comic show to comic show or eBay or however you go about buying stuff. Well, one of the easiest ways for you to do it, and one of the nice ways of doing it, is go to eaglemoss.com. The fine folks at Eagle Moss, they are a company that kind of specializes in a subscription service. And they do all sorts of subscription services from Star Trek ships, little models of Star Trek ships that you can get once a month, to WWE wrestling figure statuettes, little miniatures that you can put up on your shelf, to Harry Potter figures. The list goes on and on. Well, they have a subscription service for Star Trek graphic novels. And basically what they're doing is they're reprinting all the Star Trek comics that have come out in trade paperbacks, or actually they're hardcovers, really nice hardcover volumes that will create basically a Star Trek comics encyclopedia for you by the time it's all said and done. Each book contains a story arc as well as some classic archival comics from the golden age of Star Trek. At least that's what I would call it. And you get one once a month, or as often as they send them out, for the price of $14.95 plus shipping. And they jump around a lot. You might get a story from some classic DC Star Trek comics. You might get some Wildstorm comics from the 90s all collected together. You might get a story arc from IDW. But it's a nice way to get all your Star Trek comics all in one spot. I like it because I get a Star Trek book from time to time, and it gives me something to read. And a lot of this stuff is stuff I haven't read before. So like I said, if you're new to Star Trek comics, make sure you go to eaglemoss.com and check out what they have to offer, not only just in way of Star Trek graphic novels, but also their fine selection of really high-quality detailed Star Trek ships, WWE figurines, and the list goes on and on. So check them out at eaglemoss.com. Since this is the premiere episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, I thought I'd get you caught up on what Star Trek comic news I could find. There was a big news release back in January from IDW, which I'm going to read to you now. It's fairly relevant because this miniseries is going to be starting in April. IDW Publishing brings the beloved DS9 crew back to comics with a thriller, the four-part comic book miniseries Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Too Long a Sacrifice. Written by longtime Star Trek scribes David Tipton and Scott Tipton, and illustrated by Greg Scott, the new series marks the first Deep Space Nine title published in over a decade. Debuting its first issue in April 2020, this long-awaited DS9 storyline shines a spotlight on Constable Odo, the fan-favorite shapeshifter brought to life by the late actor René Auberjonois. Set during the most difficult hours of the Dominion War, Too Long a Sacrifice shows the station during trying times, a series of mysterious and seemingly unsolvable terrorist attacks, just as the war has everyone strained to the breaking point, says David Tipton. We'll get to see the darker side of life on the station as Odo leads the investigation, with increasingly desperate conditions forcing him and others to deal with new and unexpected allies and to use unusual tactics in their efforts to stop the attacks. Scott Tipton says, "We're so excited to return to the world of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. With its frontier setting and precarious place in the galaxy, Deep Space Nine offers the opportunity to tell truly unique tales of intrigue and suspense. Combine that with one of the best character ensembles ever assembled, and you get something no other Star Trek series can offer. I'm really excited to be spending time with the DS9 crew," says artist Greg Scott. "I've always loved Star Trek and can't wait to draw these wonderful characters." Deep Space Nine is one of the Star Trek series that I have been the most eager for IDW to dive into in comics form, so to be at the helm for the first series in over a decade is a dream come true, says editor Chase Marotz. "I've worked with David and Scott Tipton on several amazing Star Trek books, and know that they're going to deliver a story that the fans will love, and it's exciting to finally be able to work with Greg Scott. I'm a big fan of his style, and I think we're poised to create a Star Trek book that's going to both surprise and delight." It's going to come with multiple covers, of course, and like they said, it'll be out in April. So that is definitely something to look forward to, especially for me, considering that I haven't really watched too much Deep Space Nine since the series ended. Although for Christmas, my family got me the complete DS9 on DVD, so I've been working my way through that. So I am definitely poised and ready for some good DS9 comics.
Accessing library computer data.
Today on Star Trek Panel to Panel, the very first episode of Panel to Panel dealing with Star Trek comics, we are going to talk about a four-issue miniseries called Spock Reflections that IDW put out a while back. And to join me in discussing this story, I have Scott and David Tipton. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Well, this is something kind of new. I've been doing a Doctor Who podcast for a while regarding comics, and now we're going to do a Star Trek one. But usually what I start with for kind of my opening question, especially for somebody new that I haven't talked to before, is how did you two get into Star Trek, like becoming fans of Star Trek?
Oh, we grew up as Star Trek fans in our house. It was an every day at 5 p.m. on Channel 2.
So when did you grow up? Were you like I am, kind of a kid of the 70s?
Yeah, 70s kids in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that then, was one of the things. Oh, go ahead.
And then we also used to read the Gold Key comics when we were kids as well. So that was another part of it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Big fan of those.
Oh, yeah? Do you still have good fond memories of those?
Oh, they're great.
As time went on, like into the 80s, did you keep reading Star Trek comics then? Did you read like the Marvel and DC stuff like after the movies started coming out?
David, I think we had one issue of the Marvel Star Trek, right?
Yeah, it was a particularly not very good one. I think we read the comics off and on, I think, at that period. There was a lot of other things going on too at the time, so I think that that it was part of what we were reading, but not all of them, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
That Marvel Star Trek issue, it was the Haunted House issue.
Oh, okay.
But it did have some really good stuff in it, too. So, I mean, it wasn't like I hated that comic book, but, yeah, the Marvel Star Trek deal was interesting in that they couldn't use anything that was from the TV show, only stuff that appeared in the movie.
Uh-huh.
Which is kind of limiting for Star Trek. So,
yeah, exactly.
So all of a sudden, all right, Haunted House Planet, let's go.
Well, you got to do what you got to do, I guess, in order to tell the story and put a comic out. So you guys have been Star Trek fans since you were kids, and I'm assuming you've been comic fans for about the same period of time.
Oh, yeah.
So is that what led you into, how did you guys kind of come into careers as being writers? Were you both interested in writing stories, or did one have more interest in writing and the other one kind of follow along, or how did that come about?
Well, we were both working professionally as writers and editors in other fields. And then I began writing comics for IDW. I was writing Angel and some other Angel-related comics when IDW first got the Star Trek license. And so when I made a pitch and it was accepted, I realized, look, if I called up my brother and I said, look, I'm going to be calling you constantly to talk about this. And you and I have the exact same ideas about what makes a good Star Trek story. Why don't you come in and write it with me on this first one? And if you like it, we'll keep doing it.
Sure.
And it's worked out great.
Well, that's awesome. So, what was the first story that you did for IDW?
The Gorn one was the first story, right, Scott?
We had one issue of the Gorn in the Alien Spotlight.
Okay.
And then it was the Klingon Blood Will Tell.
And there was also an Orion story as well, I think.
Yeah. I think we pitched the Klingon story first, and we got that. Then the way it worked out, we wound up writing the Gorn first, and then went to Klingons.
And this was when IDW had very first got the Star Trek license, so they were kind of looking around to see how they were going to handle it. And those early Alien Spotlight issues were part of that. They were trying to see, well, what if we take a different approach? And the Alien Spotlight thing was actually something new at the time. I mean, Marvel and DC really hadn't done anything quite like that. So it was interesting stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking that was also in part a way for IDW to like find out, okay, who are some people we can use for Star Trek writers and artists?
Yeah,
because it was so new to them.
Sure, and
at that same time, they were trying to figure out what would sell for Star Trek and what wouldn't sell.
Right, because Star Trek comics were at a pretty low point before that. Sales.
Yeah, went. Yeah, and my history, I ran a comic book store for 15 years, and that was back when IDW first started coming out with Star Trek comics. I ran it from starting in the 2000, so I remember when they started putting them out, and I remember that they did those Alien Spotlights, which I thought was kind of a nice way of kind of testing some writers in one-shot issues just to see how well they could do a story, as well as they had some kind of up-and-coming artists at the time, if I remember right, too, that they were trying out. And it also kind of was a good way for them to kind of test the waters and see how well Star Trek comics would sell.
Oh, yeah. If you look at the some of those first artists on Alien Spotlight, you got David Messina, who right now is doing, I think, Iron Man or Wolverine for Marvel. You got Elena Casagrande, who is doing Black Widow for Marvel right now. Yeah. All these artists that kind of got their start on AEW Star Trek, and mm-hmm. then just quickly zoomed off to fame and fortune, which is great.
IDW Star Trek has launched a number of artistic superstars.
Yeah.
It doesn't get the credit it should for that, unfortunately. Yeah.
Rachel Stott, the first thing she ever did was our Star Trek Planet of the Apes series.
Oh, yes.
And now she's on Supergirl, and she's on all kinds of books.
Yep. Not to mention her long run on Doctor Who.
Yeah, very long run on
Doctor Who. So it sounds like you kind of... It worked out well. Your combination of being a comic writer and being a big Star Trek fan worked to your advantage into kind of getting into IDW and doing Star Trek comics.
You have to be a fan in the sense that the property is so vast. If you have at least a working knowledge of that continuity, you can get lost.
Yeah.
But it's not all about just being a fan. I mean, there are lots of fans. And so that's, I think, the mistake sometimes. People just think, well, if you're a fan, you can do anything. Well, you know, it's more than just being a fan of something. It's also, you know, story writing, understanding how a story comes together. There's a whole other side to it that it's not just the fan part.
Yeah, being a longtime fan gives you one of the tools in the toolbox that's going to help you. But yeah. If you can't come in and structure a story and work with an artist and know where you're going, it's not. And also, we also try to approach these as episodes. Like this is something that could be filmed. So we it's not about kind of like satisfying your fan needs of wanting to see certain things.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And you want to make sure that you can tell a good strong story and maybe throw in little tidbits of things to make the fans go, oh, I recognize that, or I remember that, or I know that person.
Without
you know, overbalancing that.
Yeah, it's more about just making the world feel authentic.
Sure. And that actually kind of leads into the story that we were going to talk about, Spock Reflections. And so how did the genesis of this Reflection story come about?
Well, before we start, one thing I have to caution you about is this was 10 years ago. So, I mean, I think Scott and I were both kind of racking our brain a little bit about some of those details, but we can tell you what we remember.
Yeah.
Okay.
True. And also, I mean, I have a tendency, once I'm done with a book, I never look at it again. So yesterday I pulled Spock Reflections off my shelf, and it made an audible crack on the spine when I opened it. I have not read that book literally in 10 years.
Uh-huh. And I tore apart a shelf last night trying to find some, and then I finally found a trade copy over here on another shelf. So I did this review it this morning and last night, so... We'll know, but just remember that some of the details about the origins of it, I don't quite remember.
Well, not a problem, and I know you guys have written a lot of Star Trek comics over the past 10 years, so trying to remember four issues out of your vast amount of material that you have done is probably a little bit of a challenge.
One element that Scott and I did remember last night, it's subtle here, but there is a certain connection to the 2009 Star Trek movie.
Yes.
Yeah, that was the genesis of it, if I recall, because they wanted more material to go along with the release of the movie, and they didn't want too much stuff on the marketplace that wasn't based on the movie.
Okay.
So this was like the one thing that they said, give us something set in the Prime universe that ties into Spock and being on Romulus, because that was kind of like the big surprise in the 09 Star Trek movie,
right,
that Nimoy was even in it.
And I don't think we knew all the details of the upcoming movie, but I think, Scott, if this sounds right, I think they told us just enough.
They
weren't writing the adaptation of the movie, so we weren't, you know, totally in on that circle, but we did get enough that, like, okay, we can tell this story. And I think what happened is that we pitched a story that ended up working out well with what they wanted to do. So I think that's how it happened.
Because if I recall at the time, they were making people who were working on the adaptations go down to a closet-sized office and read the script in a room. That's
their
secret. And we didn't even get that treatment. They just kind of like winked and nodded at us that, you know, Nimoy might be in the movie, so we want to focus on Spock.
That's what happened. And we didn't need to know all the details of the movie, but we knew enough, and they give us enough of a background that we think, okay, we think we can pitch to you what you're looking for. And I think we got it. It was, and that's why Nimoy's story plays, I mean, why the Spock character in the story kind of has that background element to it that kind of fits in with the movie that I was surprised when I read it. I thought, okay, I guess it worked. it been a while since I remembered that. But yeah, I think that was the genesis was, let's make this, let's show sort of some of the background material for the appearance you're going to see in the movie.
Sure. And to me, it kind of did a nice version of kind of bridging a gap, I guess, from where kind of Spock was left off in Next Generation and carrying him over into where he shows up in the movie. Not only that, but it also kind of, you did a good job of having Spock find out about what happened to Kirk. And it, that was a nice way of kind of justifying like the whole journey of the story.
Well, thanks. Yeah. That, yeah. I mean, that was, a lot of times whenever we do stuff like this, a lot of it is to if there's something that has bothered me about a certain film or movie or something that I thought, you know, this I bet we could make a better ending of that. And that can be a motivation for us in finding a way through a story.
Sure. Yeah. Is that what you tried to do here? Were you just unhappy? You had this unanswered question of how did Spock find out about the death of Kirk? And, you know, what would he do in that situation?
Honestly, I know for me, and this wasn't like the major motivation for writing the story, but I know it was on my list of things I wanted to do once we got this, we're plotting the story, is it always just bothered me that they left Kirk on Viridian.
Oh, yeah.
I just Kirk deserved better than that. And that's it. Let's fix that. So I remember actively thinking this can be a way we can fix that.
Yeah, uh-huh. I remember that being something, Scott, that you'd said early on. It's like this is a way to address that part of the story. And then from there, I think we developed the idea of, okay, what if we use this as a series of flashbacks? And then from there, we decide, okay, if we're going to do a flashback kind of a story, we need some sort of a bracketing device. And that's what led to the Saurian.
Yeah,
sure. Now,
the Saurian was interesting because, part of the reason why you do this as a writer is that if you do too much introducing things with captions, it's too much. It's like, oh, sure. God, there's another big block of text. And so the Saurian was a way to let us, you know, and also it's too much if you have Spock doing thought balloons or thinking you're talking everything to himself. So,
yeah.
The Saurian gave a device to sort of bracket the whole story. Does that sound right to you, Scott?
Yeah, it's basically, we got to give Spock someone to talk to.
Exactly.
Yeah, otherwise you're going to have a lot of just him sitting there in silence.
Yeah, and let's just make him never stop talking, because Spock would hate that.
Yeah. Now, for the flashbacks that you did, how did you come up with the ideas for those?
I mean, if I recall, it was pretty much by design in that we wanted to have one from like every major part of Spock's life that viewers had seen in movies or TV.
Okay.
Right. And so that's why there's a Kirk sequence. There's a Pike sequence. I was actually surprised. We had another Pike story here I'd forgotten about.
Yeah, I know. We do.
And so that was the tack was, okay, let's take a look at these different phases, and we'll then structure the story around those.
Okay.
And
yeah. Go ahead.
We worked in a motion picture era sequence with Christine Chapel, just because we both love the motion picture, and any chance we get to draw that to use that that ship and those uniforms, we do.
Uh huh. Did you have any problems when you were writing the story as far as getting feedback from or okays from Paramount or CBS?
I don't remember anyone on this one. Do you, David?
No, I don't remember anything on this either.
No, I mean, generally, our workings with CBS have been just very, very smooth. CBS is licensing people. I think at this point we were still working with with JVC's predecessor. What was her name?
It was Paula Block, yeah.
Paula Block, yeah. And all the way back to Paula Block to currently now we're working with John Van Sitters and with Risa Kessler.
Mm-hmm.
CBS has really smart people in their licensing department who know everything about Star Trek, but even better, they're more concerned about good storytelling.
Oh, that's awesome.
So the notes we get from them tend not to be about licensing stuff as much as like, would this work better? What I'm not feeling this point here, and they're always really concerned with making the story better. So yeah, it's super smooth. I don't recall any issues on this one.
No, I don't. There were no issues here. I don't think. Nope.
Oh well, that's awesome to hear. And I think as to when this story kind of came out right before prior to the 09 movie, it did a good job of giving people who might have gone to see Star Trek as something new for them, you know, with not having any Star Trek on the movies or on TV for a while, gave them a good kind of backstory for Spock for those people that might not know the character all that well.
Yeah, and that as I recall, that really was the genesis of the story was to provide that additional background. That's exactly it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we kind of looked at it as giving the original, because it was a big deal at the time that Zachary Quinto was coming in, and he was the new Spock, and it was all brand new. And I think in a certain way, our idea or our thinking was, we're giving the original Spock a curtain call. You know, look back at his entire life, which is. I'd forgotten, like, David, that we also included the kid Spock sequence on Vulcan.
Yeah, I remembered that one.
I'd forgotten about that one.
I'd forgotten the pipe one. Yeah.
Yeah. That I was pleased to see when I looked at it again, and the Captain Harriman sequence. Right. That's the only chance we've ever gotten to use Captain Harriman.
As I was reading the story, that was rather a nice surprise for me, because that was one of the things I enjoyed about that movie was Harriman, and how it was like, oh, I'd like to see more with him.
Yeah. What I liked about the Captain Harriman character in Generations is, you know, part of the problem with Captain Kirk, it's not a problem, but Captain Kirk makes it all look too easy sometimes.
Yeah.
So he puts somebody who is very talented and very skilled like Harriman, but he's not Captain Kirk. So he can't just jump in and do it what Kirk does so easily. Right. And at that point especially, we hadn't seen much of the idea of the flawed captain.
Yeah.
So getting to play with him was great. And then I'd forgotten we had the Savick scene, the Savick story too.
Yep.
Which we haven't gotten to use Savick much.
So it was kind of a nice way of sneaking in these characters that you enjoy.
Yeah, I remember specifically, David, we told our artist, David Messina, that we wanted Kirstie Alley Savick and not Robin Curtis Savick.
Yes, we did. Yeah. And it made sense in that context there, too. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was also kind of struck throughout. I really liked Messina's art on this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, what was it like working with David Messina? Was this fairly early on in his career?
It was early in that it was 11 years ago, and I think he had broken through to being a steady guy at IDW, but he hadn't made the jump yet to Marvel or DC or Image.
Yep.
And so I think this was our third series with him.
I think so. I think the mirror story that we did with him, was that before this one or after this one?
We did the Gorn, and then that was a one issue, and then we did the Bud Will Tell, the Klingons, and then we did Mirror Images, and then we did our Next Gen series.
Right. So yeah,
this. Yeah. So at this point, we were well used to working with him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you worked with him quite a bit at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you have any, was it like super easy to work with him then? Did you just let him kind of do his thing? And when you saw the pages, it's like, yep, that looks perfect. Yeah.
We worked with him for years. We just worked with him on Cube Conflict last year. So
yeah. Uh-huh. I think early on, the tricky part was the language barrier.
Yeah.
Because at that point, his English wasn't as good, and I was doing a lot of Google Translate with the things in Italian to get across what I was trying to do.
Go on, Scott.
Well, early on, the only problems we ever had with Messina, and this is not a problem, it's kind of funny, is that American idioms don't always translate
into
the script. So I think we made some remark about Data giving a thumbs up, and it was more like Data's just approving. And the script came back with Data giving a big thumbs up. Like, oh, no, no, no. You can't actually be giving a thumbs up. We got to check that.
The other thing that does come to mind is that at this time 10 years ago, I used to do a lot more work as far as taking screenshots and getting image references.
Yeah.
And part of that's because he needed it more, because I think he wasn't quite as up on his Star Trek then as I think he is now.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I mean, when we did Q Conflict, I don't think I sent many images or references at all, did I?
Barely any. I mean, and in the old days, we would, for every script, David would send him a file of maybe like 30 or 40 photos, screen grabs from the episodes and movies.
That was time-consuming work.
Yeah. And also because
we needed it back then. Also, I think the web, there's a lot more image reference out there now. You can Google something and find it, whereas back then, if you typed in something from Star Trek, you may or may not find a picture of it back then.
I was about to say, 11 years ago, the Google image wasn't anywhere near as populated
as
it
is. No, it was.
You can type in Vulcan shuttle right now, and you'll get like five or six screens worth of images.
Yeah, and that's kind of revolutionized the way we work in a way, because I used to have to spend a lot of time on the image reference. I
mean, so much time.
I had a whole setup here, like a production line, and I was a writer, but I had to go through and do all these screenshots from these episodes.
Yeah.
So I had all the DVDs ready. He's like, okay. I mean, it was nice to buy the DVDs myself, but it was work in that sense.
Yeah.
we needed the image reference for the artist, and uh-huh. That's not as important now, because I think, like you said, Scott. Well, I think there's two things. A, Google Image works a lot better these days, but also B, I think artists know Star Trek better, kind of in general these days.
Yeah,
and so they don't need it as much. You know, you can drop a name on someone, and someone's like, "Oh, I know who that is."
Yeah. And Messina in particular, I mean, he has gotten so much more immersed because he's been, I think, in part because he's been working on Star Trek so long, but also I think he genuinely likes it a lot more now than he did.
Yeah.
When he started. It's like when we were working on the Q Factor. He would be asking us, "Hey, can I do this version of the Borg cube from this episode of Voyager?" And we're like, no, but that's pretty cool that you know that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, we didn't get those kind of questions back then. So much.
Yeah, like I think in the Q conflict, we had described a certain kind of alien parasite that we wanted in a big scene, and he gave us a different alien parasite from
original conspiracy.
Conspiracy. Uh-huh. They're like, well. That's not the right one, but I do like those guys.
So we just left it.
So I guess it sounds like it's been kind of nice to see how David's Trek knowledge has progressed over time from the time that you started working with him till present day.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And you compare that to someone like when we work with J.K. Woodward. J.K. is such a Trek fan that we never have to give him anything.
I don't think I've ever given any image reference to J.K., no.
No.
Well, I think with him, he probably just has a big giant file of Trek stuff as it is for it to go to reference on.
Yeah, but his file's in his head.
it's scary. The JK's knowledge of that world amazes me. And that's us saying that. I've been doing this for 11 years.
I was going to say, you guys are pretty knowledgeable yourselves. Yeah. And if you say that he's... You know, head and shoulders above you. That's high praise.
The difference is that, you know, I know my characters and my stories, but JK can tell me, you know, which version of which ship it is and what angle it's from and what he doesn't like to draw it. See?
He's got that image that image reference stuff in his head, and it's really great. Yeah.
I mean, he's told us in the past no more Cardassian ships because he hates drawing them from every angle.
Well, it sounds like he has more of the artist eye for Star Trek. Of knowing, you know, the people and the places and the objects of where he can go for reference for this and that and the other thing. He's probably sat through all the shows and watched them and go, oh, I would like to use that reference for the Enterprise coming in at this particular angle, or this shot would be good going this direction.
Yeah. And we'll see him even doing stuff like that with character things, where if we want a certain emotional expression on Picard's face, he'll show us, we'll get a back, it looks great, and he'll tell us, yeah, I took it from this episode where he was thinking that. All right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, working with JK, that image acquisition process I used to run, I always think to myself, okay, he's already a guy going on in his head, so it's fine.
Uh-huh. Well, as writers for licensed comics like Star Trek, do you think it's important for an artist to be able to capture likenesses really well, or do you think they can kind of, as long as they get it fairly accurate, it fits the story okay?
Well, CBS says it's got to be really well, so
yeah.
We don't know
about saying that. Yeah. I think, I mean, it depends. I mean, a likeness doesn't need to be photoreal.
No.
Mm-hmm.
There are artists like Rachel Stott's style is much more cartoony than, say, JK's.
Yeah.
But she captures the actor in that likeness so well that I can't say that her likeness is any worse than JK's.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a different style in some ways. And so even though you can jump from style to style, there's definitely a certain expectation of a level of likeness that they're looking for. And as the writers, we're looking for it too, because a lot of times we write these with, I mean, there's a couple scenes in an upcoming Deep Space Nine where we're really depending on the artist getting a certain look right, just like, you know, the expression on the face, and so that matters to us as well.
Sure.
Especially because we've been trying more over the years to not. I go back and I look at our first Klingon book, and I feel so sorry for Messina, because we were so new at it, and there's just so much dialogue, and we covered up so much of his art.
Uh-huh.
So as we've gotten better at this over the years, I'd like to think, and we've gotten to know our artists better, and we know what they're good at. We can actually trust our artists to get across emotional points through acting and not need so much dialogue.
Yeah. And you can kind of let the artist kind of use their illustrations or, you know, facial expressions on characters to kind of carry over a feeling without having to use so many words in which to describe that feeling.
Exactly. Yeah. And Dave mentioned it, there's a lot of that in our new Deep Space Nine series, and we've gotten some pages back from Greg Scott, and wow, they look great. Very very broody, very 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 emotional. It's great.
And actually, kind of tangenting off a little bit onto that, as far as like new work that you're working on, you guys are working on this DS9 series for IDW, which will be coming out in roughly another month or so. So that's kind of your current project. How has it been going back to Deep Space Nine?
It's great, because we've only got to do it really once before. We did one series a few years ago, but,
and we were the last ones to do Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, we were. it's great to get back to that world for me, but it's also one that I'm always more nervous about, because when I write Next Gen, I can hear the voices in my head so easily. Uh-huh. And I don't have the confidence with DS9. Luckily, David does. So I just run everything through my DS9 filter and past David as far as our character voices.
Okay.
Yeah, and with Deep Space Nine, which is so character driven, I mean, Next Generation was character driven, but Deep Space Nine is like character driven squared, and so
yeah.
Having to get those elements is really important. So, yeah, I think it's been going really well. I like the story a lot. The artist we got is great. It's a good story.
Well, that's awesome to hear. I'm looking forward to reading it. I've been getting back into DS9. I got the complete series on DVD for Christmas, so I've been watching it little by little. And it's really kind of, it's setting me up for this miniseries that'll be coming out. So
yeah, and I think with Deep Space Nine right now, between the documentary that came out and it along with Voyager has been getting a lot of views on Netflix and streaming. Mm-hmm. I think both of those series are sort of having a little bit of a comeback in a way that we might not have thought a few years ago.
Yeah, most definitely. They always, you know, it's kind of, everybody seems to picture Next Gen as the sequel of choice as far as like going off of original series Trek. And then Deep Space Nine is the one that everybody cheers for, but they don't seem to talk about all that much. And Voyager is like kind of the lost child that nobody seems to claim.
Yeah,
but my understanding is actually one of the most popular ones on Netflix. So I think the thing with Voyager is that these things go in like these 20 years gaps, and for a while everybody thinks, oh, I didn't like that, and then they turn around and then think, well, maybe it wasn't so bad. And I'm starting to see that with Enterprise now too.
Is that, yeah.
Oh, we liked Enterprise. It wasn't that bad after all. And so. It has to do a lot with nostalgia and what people were watching when they were younger.
Yep.
And I also think Voyager was misunderstood kind of from the get-go. I know it was by me, in that I didn't understand that the whole point of the series from the beginning is it's supposed to be that it's a flawed crew. So they're going to make mistakes and things aren't going to be going the way they should. So I think once I kind of got that through my head and realized that, I was able to enjoy the show much more for what it was. And those stories they're telling are work pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It is every series of Trek has hits and misses, and you know, Voyager is definitely one where there were some episodes I thought were really well done and other ones not quite so much, but as long as it's a fairly solid story, I'm happy with pretty much any Star Trek.
And to go back to DS9 for a moment, that documentary, is it What We Left Behind, David?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. That documentary is excellent. So yeah, I highly recommend that.
Yeah, I would totally agree. In fact, that was part of my Christmas present as well, is getting that to go with the complete series.
Very nice.
So, yeah, it's a well-done documentary. So, well, I'm looking forward to the Deep Space Nine miniseries when it comes out here in another month or so. And I really enjoyed Spock Reflections. It was nice to go back and kind of see this overview of Spock's life as he, you know, travels to see off Captain Kirk. And I want to thank both of you for being on my maiden voyage of the Star Trek Panel, the Panel podcast. And I hope we can chat again sometime about one of your other projects.
Well, Eagle Moss has put a whole bunch of our books in that line, so
Well, that's awesome. I'll definitely be chatting with you more as I start working my way through all these volumes.
Cool.
Sounds good.
All right, thanks. Scott and David Tipton, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thanks.
Bye.
Transfer of data is complete.
Thanks to Scott Tipton and David Tipton for taking time out of their schedule to chat with me about Spock Reflections as well as learning more about them. I had talked to Scott Tipton before for my Doctor Who podcast because he wrote the Star Trek Next Generation Doctor Who crossover. And so it was nice chatting with him again as well as his brother, and this time on Star Trek ground. So I hope you enjoyed this chat. I hope you enjoyed this episode, this premiere episode, and I hope to hear feedback from people. Please reach out to me, whether it be on Facebook under Star Trek Panel to Panel, or you can look for me under Jeremy Bement, the one that has the Panel to Panel logo with it. And you can also reach out to me on Twitter. That's at Star Trek P2P, 2 being the number 2 for Panel to Panel. And with that, I guess that's it. Thanks for downloading this episode. Please let your friends know about it. Please let other Star Trek fans know about it. And I hope to see you again next time. So until then, this is Jeremy Bent saying bye. Thank you for downloading this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, the internet's premier podcast about Star Trek comics. You can find us on Facebook at Star Trek Panel to Panel and on Twitter at Star Trek P2P, 2 being the number 2. You can always find Star Trek Panel to Panel wherever you get your favorite podcast and can always find previous episodes on archive.org. Please let other Star Trek fans know about this podcast and leave us a positive review on iTunes. Thank you for listening, and until next time, happy readings.